you even listening to me? Can I talk to you for a second?
Oh my God, I was dying.
You totally have to hear this. Do you have a minute right now?
It's important, okay?
Just keep it on the dime. Just keep it on the dime.
I feel like you're not ready right now.
Welcome to the Overshare Show. I'm Tony.
I'm Grace.
And today we're going to be talking to Carla Garrick. Carla is the president of an initiative called the Free State Project, which is a libertarian effort to bring 20,000 people to the state of New Hampshire.
And we found Carla after reading a New York Times article about Free Keene, which is sort of an affiliate of the Free State Project. And it is made up of people that call themselves Robin Hooders. And they are in Keene sort of tracking the meter maids. And what they do is find people whose meters
are
have
about
expired,
to run out, yeah.
Right, expired, and they feed them so that they can't be, you know, given a ticket.
I've actually been the beneficiary to one of these Robin Hooders because I went into the organic store to buy $17 grapes. And when I came out, it took too long. I had a card on my car that said, hey, guess what? You were going to get a ticket and we saved you.
Right.
So if you want to donate, why don't you give money here and pay it forward? And I didn't initially make the connection that this was a libertarian group. I just thought, awesome, I didn't get a ticket.
And you're like, thank God, because I didn't have anything left after going to the organic grocery store.
I know, I was like, I'm actually really poor right now after that. So anyway, I really wanted to interview Carla because I do think personally that there is a major problem with the political landscape as it exists right now. And I'm not saying I necessarily am a libertarian, but I know that I'm not necessarily a Democrat, and I know I'm not necessarily a Republican either. Political systems all have a certain logic to them on paper. I think if you were to look at them each individually, you would find something that's appealing to you. Yet at the same time, the real question is, how do they come into practice? How do people actualize these political ideologies? And I think that's why it's really important that we examine the political systems that we've all agreed to, and it sometimes figure out ways to improve upon them. I think there are problems that aren't necessarily being addressed by the same minds that created them. So why not be open-minded and look into different types of thinking and types of philosophies that may or may not be more reasonable for people to enact? I mean, I'm not sure. I just think the conversation is what's worth having. And I just really wanted to hear what a third party voice sounded like.
I agree. Same here. And I just feel like it's important to examine your principles and hear other ideas in general. Dissent is sometimes uncomfortable, and sitting with a problem, you know, doesn't feel good, but it's, you know, it's important to examine your own ideas.
Yeah, and dissent is a part of the political participation. And even though there are people who are outraged and keen, and I've created a Stop Freeing Keen, you know, initiative, that is in and of itself is important. And the reason why I felt like Carla was an interesting representative of the libertarian movement is because the libertarians that I personally have been exposed to have been more the types that wear like Confederate flag belts.
Right.
So I'm not sure if they're actively racist as much as just racially insensitive, but I was never
stylistically challenged.
Exactly. But I was never particularly moved by the libertarians I've met so far because it seemed to be kind of like an exclusive white male extremist ideology.
I sort of had this stereotype in my head of the camel wearing, you know, gun toting, angry guy with a deer slung over his truck. Couldn't reconcile how that might include me.
Right, exactly. And I think that Carla is an interesting representative of this movement because she's very rational. She has an open mind. She's also obviously a woman. And I think that when we talk about these issues, these vast grand meta issues when it comes to our political system, there's never going to be one specifically right answer. But the point is that we have these conversations and connect with one another and work together to solve them. Because if we just stand back like John Mayer, you know, like, hey, I'm waiting for the world to change, like, that's not going to work. Like, we really have to be a part of it. I actually got really depressed halfway through, or like towards the end of this.
I looked over and Tony was like slumped in her chair. And like, there was a cloud over her head.
I know. Like, sometimes
it's going to be okay.
Thinking about politics is difficult and it's encompassing and hard because it's so easy to feel impotent. And no one likes to feel impotent physically, emotionally, or spiritually. It's probably the worst thing you can feel. So Carla is someone who has a lot of hope.
Yes, she
has a lot
of drive. She was a great antidote.
Yeah.
She was like a philosophical Viagra.
I really am into that. So I hope you appreciate the conversation, even if you have different political beliefs. We need to be committed to the dialogue, because if we're not talking and we're not participating and we're not putting pressure on each other to be political, the government isn't going to do that, because the less active we are, the better it is for the government. Yes. Because they're just going to do what they want to do.
Can't be a numb sheep.
No, I don't want to be a numb sheep. We need to be wolves.
Rawr.
Do wolves make that noise?
This wolf does. I don't know.
So thank you so much for listening. And again, it's freekeen.com, and Carla's project that she's the president of is the freestateproject.org. I have to say, I was really glad there wasn't any meters at your parking lot, because it would have been like a major philosophical debate. Like, do I pay the meter? Do I go up and ask her for change directly? And just be like, hey, can you pay this for me? So let's start off with talking about what's going on in Keene, because that's kind of what brought us to begin with. So tell me a little bit about the history of that.
Sure. So the Free State Project, of course, is trying to attract 20,000 libertarians or liberty lovers to move to the state of New Hampshire. And a lot of people have settled in the town of Keene. It seems to attract a lot of the more civil disobedient people who are really just sort of trying to shine the light on, you know, some of the stuff the state does that people might not think about. So the Free Keene group, I guess some people from that group and some just natives and locals from the town of Keene decided they were going to start this thing called Robin Hooders. And what they've done is they go around to parking meters and they feed the meters right before the attendant is about to write a ticket, and then leave a little card with a Robin Hood kind of thing saying, we have saved you from the king's tariff, you know. And then there's this pay it forward idea where people can go and they can donate money to help other people, to help them to feed the meters. So that's sort of where it started. It seemed like it was an incredibly playful, fun way to do a little bit of liberty outreach. I mean, I don't like getting parking tickets. I think most people don't like getting parking tickets. But it then turned into this sort of bigger deal. And the city sued some of the Robin Hooders. The city lost their case. And it's been a riot. I mean, we're on the front page of the New York Times on Monday with the story. So I guess it's got legs.
One question that I had that was I was a little bit confused by or struck by was that there's been this counter activist movement of people being like, stop freeing us. So what do you think that's about? Like, why do you feel like the citizens of Keene who feel like they're more locals or they have more of necessarily a right to be there because they've been there longer, and them kind of feeling alienated or isolated by this movement?
I want to make it clear the Free State Project, which I'm the president of, and Free Keene are sort of loosely affiliated. I mean, one of the fascinating things when you deal with liberty lovers is, you know, I like to say freedom is messy and people are going to do different things and have different tactics. So I think in the past there has been activism that has been done in Keene that was more questionable. There were certainly things, you know, 6-7 years ago, and I did an interview with Laura Kanoy on NHPR once, and she brought this up because she lives in Keene, and there had been activism where it was a young lady, and she was topless, and she was open carrying, and she was smoking a joint, and she got arrested. And it was on, you know, it was on the square, which is close to schools and that kind of stuff. So I think for some people, it's, you know, it's sort of a protection of their children. You know, they're concerned. I think some people, whenever you're doing something like civil disobedience, you know, you're going to push some buttons. And part of the idea, of course, is to start to open up a dialogue and to get people talking. So I would say with something like Robin Hooding, I was actually really surprised that that started to attract negative attention, you know, from people saying, you know, this is bad. I mean, I think there were things tactically that I did not think was a good idea that they did years ago, sort of the example I just gave. And actually, even in that case, everything the woman was doing was actually, maybe she wasn't smoking a joint, because everything she had done, so she was open carrying topless. And that was all legal. So when she got arrested, really from a civ dis perspective, she should have sued, right? Because she was allowed to do those things. So if you're going to do civil disobedience, you know, like take it all the way, kind of work it through the system. So I don't know. I think some of the natives, you know, are just... I think there's a lot of misinformation out there as well. So people kind of, anything that sounds strange or weird or happens, free staters or free keeners get blamed for it. And then maybe this is just sort of the camel that broke the back. I don't really know.
I mean, I personally feel like dissent is important. And even if there is this like anti-group on Facebook or what have you of people going against the free keeners, that political participation is way more relevant than I think what goes on most of the time, which is people being completely disengaged and feeling disempowered, or that, you know, they're not necessarily a part of their political system. So in that way, even if people are angry, at least they're talking.
That's kind of how I feel too, is let's start a dialogue. You know, I do a lot of outreach with, my background is with writing. So I hang out with, you know, artsy teachers and stuff, you know, and sometimes they're just like, you what? You know, you're involved with what, you know? But then we'll talk about it. And really the ideas and the philosophy of it isn't that scary. I mean, what we're saying basically is that people should take personal responsibility, you know, with their self-ownership. I own myself and I should be able to make decisions about my life for myself. Something like marijuana to me just seems ridiculous, that we have a government that tells you you can't use a plant. Like, how do you ban nature? You know, so it's that those sort of things. And when you start to talk to people, you can start that dialogue. The question becomes, you know, do you want to talk to people in a way that's confrontational? Do you want to, you know, like what are better tactics? What are better ways to do it? And, you know, I actually really thought the Robin Hood idea was cute. Like when I heard about it, I was like, oh, this is neat. You know,
that was actually my first reaction. I was at the library and I was Robin Hooded, I guess, and I got the little card and I was like, oh, that's cute. But one of the things you're talking about, using different tactics, going on their page, and they had a little video, which, you know, I love the Disney movie, so I was definitely drawn to that. But there was, you know, it seemed like they were kind of, you know, following this meter maid around, and in a way that, you know, felt like, or looking at it made me feel a little uncomfortable, like, oh, this poor woman is, you know, might be feeling harassed or something like that. And I know that I was actually wondering about the kind of dialogue around freedom, because it is messy, and it's hard to combine freedom with security and stability. So, you know, what part of the dialogue, how do you address that?
Wow, that's a hard question. I mean, I think, you know, there's a famous quote, I think it's Jefferson, who said, you can't trade freedom for security, because in the end you lose both. I mean, certainly I think for me personally, you know, I came from South Africa in the mid-90s. I won a green card, which is why I moved here. I was, you know, an anti-apartheid activist. I grew up in a police state. So after 9/11, I really started to see a remarkable change in this country in a way where it has become reminiscent of growing up in a police state. You know, when I moved to America, the first business trip I ever went on, I got to the airport like 2.5 hours before I was supposed to go, because that's how it worked back home, because they were going to search you and do all these things. And you know, they laughed at me. They're like, no, you can show up like 30 minutes before your flight. You know, if you have a carry-on, you can just get on your airplane. And now I'm like, oh my God, it's worse here than it used to be there, you know? And so there's that balance that we have to find. But I believe freedom is always the answer, even if it is messy, because we shouldn't be able to coerce each other to do things that are, you know, against your beliefs or your principles or your values or any of those things just because we think it'll make the world a better place. We have to let the best world we can have is where everyone can decide what those values and principles are. When I look at something like democracy, what makes sense about like 51% of people deciding what 49% of people are going to do? It really, when you analyze it, starts to not make a lot of sense. You know, the standing joke is democracy is two wolves and a sheep deciding what's for dinner. And it doesn't work out well for the sheep, you know?
Right. Well, one question that I have about, you know, the Free Keen movement specifically is that it seems more like an ideological message. Like, it's not necessarily about, you know, the specific meter maids that are going around issuing tickets. But yet, when you're doing something in a small community, it becomes very personal. You know, so when people are trying to make these, like, meta conversations, yet they're doing it in the place where they live and they're doing it to actual human beings who are trying to do their job and aren't necessarily seeing eye to eye, like, that what they're doing by issuing tickets is necessarily wrong, especially if you look at it from, you know, the businesses that want turnover on their street or what have you. So, I mean, how do you kind of reconcile when people in a local community want to make these meta conversations happen, yet they're kind of not terrorizing their neighbors, but that's how their neighbors come to feel?
And I think that's a legitimate concern. I was just in New York, and part of my speech was really about how do you communicate these messages in a way that is palatable. You know, I constantly say, like, I'm here to be a good neighbor. You know, I volunteered at the Concord Public Library until the city of Concord's police chief called me a domestic terrorist, and then I felt less inclined to, you know, do my civic duty in that way. But I think part of the challenge is a lot of people who are attracted to these ideas are actually incredibly smart, geeky guys, right? And they may not have the best people skills. Like, I almost feel like they don't think it through, you know? Some of the Robin Hooders are peaches. I mean, they're just really sweet people. Two of the most antagonistic ones, as far as I could tell, were locals. And so, you know, who knows how what the best way to do it. But I do think that, you know, people who choose to move here should, I mean, part of the reason the state of New Hampshire was chosen is because we felt like there were shared values. We felt like this is a place that sort of still embraces rugged individualism and still embraces, you know, live free or die and live and let live and you know, and has a kind of core sense of individualism. And so I do think we picked the right place. I also think that, you know, some of these kids can learn to communicate better and to open the dialogue in a way that doesn't feel like, you know, they're being invaded or they're, you know, and not everyone, certainly from the Free State Project's point of view, you know, there are a lot of people who live in Keene who are Free Staters who no one's ever heard of, who actually have an active dislike of the tactics that, you know, a certain crew takes. But we believe in freedom, so, you know, all you can do is say, well, you know, I might have done this differently. Or by way of example, I'm a former attorney, and so I feel when people get arrested for civil disobedience, like I said earlier, well, then take it to the max, right? Sue, get a lawyer, work it through the system, which kind of happened in the Robin Hooding case, right? But it was the city, of course, that sued. But that was probably smart, you know? I also know the attorney who is prosecuting me and something else. You know, maybe it was tactical from their perspective as well. But it's never going to be perfect. But I do think there is value, and even just having this interview to say, oh, I read that article and I'm curious and let's talk about it, you know, I think is a good way to approach it. And there's a very large silent majority in New Hampshire who actually appreciates us coming. I mean, I get, you know, 2-to-1 letters saying, thank you, you're here. It's this kind of reinforcements as opposed to, hey, you know, you're the invasive species.
I was wondering about where these people are coming from. Like, are there particular areas there that a lot of people are moving from?
And can you also, sorry, can you also explain the Free State Project, too, in case people don't know?
Okay. So the Free State Project has been around for just over a decade now. It was actually the brainchild of Jason Sarens, who is teaching up at Dartmouth now. He was at Yale at the time, and he was a libertarian who felt really frustrated that libertarians get nowhere in the electoral process. There was a reason for it, because it's basically, you know, they want to stack it so it's two parties and we can have this sort of artificial fight between the left and the right instead of really looking at what, you know, the big picture is. So I guess he wrote this paper and said, wouldn't it be cool if a bunch of libertarians concentrated in one place? He suggested it should be a small state with a small population that already did well on freedom metrics, economic freedoms, personal freedoms, those kinds of things. And so they took a vote. There were 10 states. They let people vote on which state they thought would be the best, and New Hampshire won. And so 10 years ago, they said, okay, it's New Hampshire, let's start to move. And the organization itself has been volunteer-driven until like September, October last year. I actually took this as a paid position, as a real job. But we just, you know, so people came here, and so the idea is that we get 20,000 people, which is just a number Jason made up. It was really just kind of a thumb suck. Yeah, I mean, I kind of wish it had been 10,000 because then we'd be done by now. But so the way it works is people pledge our statement of intent, which people can go read at freestateproject.org, and so they pledge, and then once we get to 20,000 people who've pledged, people have 5 years to move. So we're currently at about 16,000. So we're getting
pledges.
Okay. And so, you know, we're starting to get close to, I'm hoping we can trigger the move in the next 2 years, and then people will start to actually move. Now, a bunch of people moved early. So someone like Ian Freeman from Free Talk Live, who's actively involved in the Free Keen movement, they moved out, I think, in 2007. My husband and I came out from New York in 2008. So I sort of see the early movers as kind of the pioneers. But with any pioneer movement, you're also going to have a fringe element or a sort of, you know, like the cutting edge, the hardcore people, the, you know, and I think we've seen a bit of that. I would certainly say most of the movers we're getting now seem to be, young families or people who are coming out maybe after their first job. They're literally, I mean, and this has happened at least with four couples that I can think of, you know, they're young, they're in their mid-20s, they rent a place for the first year, they buy a dog, the men often buy a truck, because apparently that's like what you
very
need
New
to
Hampshire.
That's what you do in New Hampshire.
Right? Or a Subaru. That's the other car that I
he gets anyway. A truck, and then they buy a home, they get their puppy, and then the wife gets pregnant. And people who might have like not positive views about the Free State Project, and I think primarily more Free Keen, I think, you know, we just kind of get lumped in together, don't hear about these people, because most of the Free Staters who are here have jobs, we're, you know, volunteering, people run soup kitchens, people, you know, run private charities, like
they're
all this stuff is going
community.
On, but they're just part of the community. They're not walking around being like, let me shake things up.
I was wondering, you said before that there's a lot of young men in the movement, and I've heard that before about libertarianism in general, that it attracts not just men, but white men.
Right.
And I'm wondering about why you think that other people are not, or other populations are not as attracted to it. And is there anything that you do to...
I think it's... I honestly, like, I have thought about this, and I think it's an early adopter problem. Like, you know, I think with any philosophical idea, and it's not like, you know, these ideas haven't been around, but, you know, they'll emerge every 200 to 300 years. Someone has a revolution, and then people are like, oh, right, we were meant to be free, and then a big government comes along, and then, you know, and I just think it's the cycle of life in some ways, not to get too meta, But I think it's an early adopter idea. And I think the internet is actually changing that. You know, we just had Liberty Forum in February, and Naomi Wolf was one of our keynote speakers. And I specifically wanted to recruit her. I was like, I've been reading her since, you know, I was in college. I was like, she's a progressive third wave feminist, but she has written two books in the past 5 years that really talk from a leftist perspective of the same things that someone like Ron Paul, who comes from the right, would talk about, which is, hey, here are 10 steps to fascism, and, you know, we're at number 7, you know, you have to, you know, get radiated or searched, like, you have to take your shoes off to get on an airplane. And that is actually it's security theater that is designed to belittle you. That is designed to, like, keep you in place, citizen. I mean, these are all things that come out of a checklist, pretty much. So she had written these two books, and I was like, oh, let's bring her out. So because she came to Liberty Forum, you know, we did a feminism panel, and I just got back from New York where we did a all-women's, you know, there were 14 women speakers at a big Liberty conference. And so I feel like, okay, you know, it sort of started with white males, and then it's starting to go over to women. It's going over to, like, other races and ethnicities. And I just think it's an issue of the idea has to start somewhere. And now we're in the fortunate position where technology is really setting us all free, because we can get the real story. And if you're interested in an idea, you can go research it and be like, oh, this is cool. You know, I mean, one of the longest serving members on our board has been Black. We have equal number women and men. We've had more women presidents than males. So I think it's sort of a narrative that people want to tell, because then they can try and make it something it's not really. But traditionally it has been the case, but I think that's changing.
I mean, you bring up this issue of security, and I always find it kind of fascinating that we as a population have sacrificed so many of our civil liberties in the name of security, because we want to feel quote unquote safe. But really what's making us the most unsafe are these endless wars in countries that are creating, you know, hate, resentment, and terrorism, because we're killing and then there's reciprocity of people wanting to kill us. So, I mean, I do think that there's, like, a major sense of irony between what we want to give up and how we are relinquishing our rights. But at the same time, like, one of the questions I have about libertarianism and democracy, I don't personally believe we live in a true democracy, right, or even communism, is that how do any of these ideas or philosophies exist in a world that's controlled by capitalism? And I know there's this direct relationship between libertarianism and the free market, but to me that just seems semi-problematic, in the sense that, like, capitalism is inherently and currently so deeply corrupt. So how is libertarianism going to address that or change that? Not to say that democracy is, but do you get what I'm saying?
I do. And actually, I think your word choice there was very interesting, because you actually said libertarianisms believe in the free markets. And that is correct. What we have in this country, I mean, I think it was Princeton, it was one of the Ivy League schools, just recently came out with a report where a study, and I was shocked when I read it, because, you know, they're an Ivy League school, they're kind of part of the system, and they were like, hey, America's an oligarchy. And I was like, bravo, someone figured it out, right? You know, we had a lot of people come over to the Free State Project from the Occupy side. And I actually think that's where the synergy is, right? That's where it's kind of like everyone knows something's wrong, but none of us can put our finger on how to fix it. So I would posit that free markets are something different to the capitalism we see now. In fact, I think what we primarily see is crony capitalism, which I like to call craptalism. And, you know, so we live in a craptalistic world, which really has nothing to do with free markets. Why does that world exist? Pretty much for two reasons. Because government exists, and government grants a monopoly to corporations to act in a way that protects them, gives them limited liability, and all these things that do not naturally live in a true free market. So in a perfect world, like idealistically speaking, I think what would happen in a true free market, right, you could merge sort of the ideas of democracy, but tie it to you vote with your dollars, right? So let's, for the sake of argument, we just say, okay, there's no government, right? So now we have corporations, right? So at first we're going to say, okay, there are these giant big corporations and they're just going to bully us all and force us to do things we don't want to do. But it's like, if they don't have the power of government, how do they force you? How does Microsoft over Apple force you to do something? No, you choose, and you choose with your dollars. You might buy an Apple product that's 3 times more than a PC, but you're like, I want to buy it because I value these things. It's pretty, it works easily. You know, it can do artsy things. It's designed for a right brain over, you know, left brain. And that's what the free market truly would give us. So if you could eliminate the government, right, then we would have companies, and they wouldn't be corporations. It would just be people giving us services. And then in a world, you know, where someone says, I don't like Walmart, you're like, okay, my town, no one likes Walmart. People don't want to buy there. So they're like, I'm not going to buy from Walmart, right? And then someone else can say, well, why don't people like Walmart? Well, they don't like it because all the products come from China. It kind of hurts our local economy. It puts moms and pops out of business. Well, if you live in a community that values moms and pops, then vote with your dollars and support those people. So the free market would actually sort those things out, I believe. And for any industry where the government has not been involved, prices have gone down and services have gone up. And a perfect example of that was LASIK eye surgery was never regulated. And, you know, maybe, I mean, I had mine probably 10, 15 years ago now, right? And let's say it was $4,000 at the time. And it wasn't covered by medical aid, so you had to pay out of pocket. And it was really just a free market transaction. And over the time that that service has been provided, the price has dropped consistently, and everything has gotten better. And that was just because it was this little thing that no one really paid attention to. But it's a great example of what happens if you get government out of the way. Another great example is just our phones. I mean, why do we get better and better and better technology that gets cheaper and cheaper? And it's because that's the one thing where we're winning. The government doesn't really understand technology. The scary part is they're starting to. And as we get into this system that's beyond even crony capitalism, that is actually starting to move, in my opinion, towards fascism, where it's not only that, you know, it's an oligarchy, but also that, like, we're going to protect these big corporations against any form of competition. But with technology, we're still winning. Like, we're still ahead of the game. But the government is now starting to outsource things to, you know, we saw it in the wars that you brought up, you know, where we start to get these defense contractors, and suddenly there's a lot of money, and there's a lot of, you know, power that comes with these positions, and they actually have a craptalism incentive to do their job well. Like, no one's holding the government's feet to the fire. You go to the DMV and you're like, eh, it's gonna suck. And we just all know it. And it's like, what am I gonna do? Complain? Everyone complains about the DMV, right? But let's say something like BAE Systems or Zay, you know, Blackwater became Zay, became something else. You know, they keep changing their names so that people should know who the bad guys are, right? They actually have incentives as a business to do a good job at killing people, to do a good job at, you know, national intelligence, you know, surveillance, all this national surveillance that's going on. And that's where I get scared, where I'm like, oh, suddenly someone is going to start to do a good job of suppressing us, and then we're in big trouble.
Yeah, one thing I did have a question about in terms of regulation and the free market and, like, kind of what you were describing with technology, for instance. I mean, with the eye surgery example, there's no true environmental impact of that. So the need for regulation, in my book, is minimal. But when you're talking about, like, technology, for instance, like, there is a vast environmental impact. And with a lot of big industry, there's, you know, huge environmental consequences. And I'm not saying the government is doing their job when it comes to regulation, but, like, how can there be regulation when it comes to environmental destruction when there is an opportunity for corporations to hide consequences and to externalize a lot of the, you know, environmental impact? onto the consumer and the dollars that they're paying. So, I mean, how does the libertarian perspective deal with environmentalism? Is that even a concern?
It is a concern. That's a legitimate question. It's one that comes up a lot. The easiest way to explain it, although it's not always satisfactory, not even really to me, and it is something I need to research a little more, but basically you solve that problem with true property rights. So if, you know, and this used to be how it worked under common law. So, you know, if you had the upriver problem, right? So someone's polluting upriver and I'm a fisherman and you're killing my fish. If there's true property rights, then, you know, you can say, hey, you're destroying my property and therefore you should be held liable. The problem is, first of all, the courts have just veered off any sense of true common law. You know, maybe in the past 200 years, I was just listening to a really interesting podcast this morning where this, you know, old crankety, crotchety professor was like, there is no rule of law anymore, you know? And I was like, what? You know? And then he explained it in a way where he's basically saying, you know, it's become everyone's opinion, right? Whatever that judge thinks, you know, these words don't mean anything anymore. You know,
opinions are dollars, and
What is it? Congress shall make no laws to abridge, you know, the your right to free. Shall make no laws to abridge free speech, right? We now in this country have free speech zones. How do you have a free speech zone if you have the right to free speech? It's like it's an oxymoron. So with environmentalism, it is one of the tougher questions. That's a great question to ask because I'm not really an expert on it. But what I've read is basically if you look at true enforcement of property rights and private contract, then those things can sort of be sorted out. And that would involve things like actually with something like an ocean, actually figuring out, and this has been done, that they did this in New Zealand, where they actually gave the fishermen ownership of pieces of the ocean, like where their nets were and stuff. And it was remarkable how fast, like, the fish came back and everyone was really paying attention. And it was something I saw in South Africa as well, where there was a lot of problems with poaching and, you know, just killing animals. And once they started to really enforce property rights, people started to take pride in it, you know, and they would tag their animals, they would, you know, cull responsibly if they had to. So there is no easy solution, but I think we can figure it out. And I like to say, you know, if your trade-off is, a lot of times people will say to libertarians, you know, but what about the roads? Do you drive on the roads? Do you, you know? And it's like, we had 280 million people were killed by democide in the last century. So that's, you know, that's not even the wars. That's just governments, like, killing people. You know, it's Stalin. It's America, too. You know, people like to gloss over things like, you know, Nagasaki and Hiroshima and that kind of stuff. But, you know, so all these regimes that have murdered all these people. And I just say, you know, that level of murder, so 280 million people. There were only 8 million people killed by, like, private murders. So I'm like, I kind of would rather take, you know, my chances with, like, the one crazy sociopath than to empower all these people to go and be like, yeah, let's go drone bomb some kids, you know?
The other reality, though, is that people in war often kill for religious reasons. And even if there is this political agenda between world leaders, the humans that are doing the killing have, like, a different motivation. You know, so it's like, do you see libertarianism as something that works globally as well, especially within that context?
I think so, because I think if... I mean, I think that the religious wars might be mildly exaggerated, you know, for use by government. I think in particular, you know, sort of the narrative of this, you know, evil, crazy Muslim people who just want everyone in America to die because of our freedoms. You know, it's like, no, they probably don't like us because we're killing their fathers, sons, children, mothers, daughters, you know. and have been having bases, military bases in this area for, you know, 50, 60 years. So, yeah, they probably feel like they've been invaded by America. With religion, I believe that libertarianism, or I mean, in a more purist form, I guess, anarchism, but that's a word that scares people and they think it means chaos, which it really doesn't. It just means no rulers. It doesn't mean no rules. It just says no one's the boss of you, but you can decide amongst yourselves what rule to apply to your community or to your group, or, you know. And so I think freedom benefits all of mankind. And I think allowing people to flourish with freedom is the best answer to all of life's questions.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And it's different ways that people think that it's going to come about. And I'm wondering sort of what it looks like in a libertarian utopia. Like, what I know that big government is definitely frowned upon, but is local government okay? Like, what do these communities look like? How big do they get, and how do you regulate?
I mean, there is no perfect answer, right? I mean, I think the closest, certainly in American history, was back in the 1800s, you know, things where people will talk about, oh, it was the Wild West. If you actually go study that period, it really wasn't that wild. You know, it's sort of Hollywood created this narrative, you know, which is a great story. You know, it's prostitutes and cowboys and everything. But it was, you know, legitimately actually fairly safe. Murder was pretty low. People were free to do what they wanted, you know, and they were pioneers.
Just really dusty.
That's just dusty, right? And dry, you know, and certainly challenging. I mean, I think if we enforced real property rights, then you would see things like covenants, which we see on golf courses or whatever, where people say, we're all going to buy property together here, and we agree to abide by these rules. And, you know, I used to live up in Eastman and Grantham on a golf course. I was just renting, but I found it so amusing because all the properties had to be painted sort of within the same shades of...
It's like historical districts. They're like, that is not true. Yeah, colonial yellow?
I know. And this wasn't even historical. This was just kind of like they were agreeing on it. But there was just this like sort of awesome, like, I don't know if it was like Yankee individualism or something. I guess there was a loophole in whatever the place's rules were that they didn't specify what color you could paint your door. So everyone had these like muted, you know, houses, and then the craziest color doors, you know, fuchsia and purple and
psychedelic.
Yeah, you know, where it was just people rebelling against those rules. I don't know what the perfect number is. I don't know how big it'll be. I certainly think local government is way, way, way better than, you know, the federal government. At least one of the things I love about New Hampshire is that it does have a big legislative body. And, you know, most people represent, if you're a state rep, you're representing about 3,000, 3,200 people. And everyone knows you. And, you know, they can call you at your house and talk to you, you know, and it really is more intimate and real. And it's a lot harder, I think, for people to screw each other over when they have to look you in the eye, you know, and you can be like, excuse me, what did you do? No, you know.
There's a different accountability for sure when it's right. More personal. But like from my understanding, or at least from an observer's perspective, libertarianism definitely has a greater trust in the individual than what currently exists when we are saying like the government is what's going to keep us trustworthy rather than saying like humans are inherently trustworthy and should be treated as such. Yet one of the questions that I felt like kept coming up over and over again was these ideas of social services, you know, like helping the elderly or public education or healthcare or universal healthcare specifically, and saying like, you know, what are the libertarians going to do when they need these services? You know, so is that just like a misinformed perspective, or is there something specific that you can say that talks about social services and the fact that many people do feel a genuine need for them?
Well, I want to address two things. First of all, you know, to say that the government is this magical thing, right, that does all this stuff. What is the government? It's just made up of people, right? And Bastiat in The Law actually says it the best, and I'm going to paraphrase it with a Facebook meme, which was basically, you know, it was a circle of words that just went round, and the words were, people are bad, therefore we need government made up of people are bad, therefore we need government made up, right? And that really, really knocked me, you know, hard, because I was like, wow, that kind of is true. With regard to social services and stuff, I think two thoughts. The first one is, libertarian philosophy is actually based on the moral belief that anything that we as individuals can't do, the government shouldn't be able to do, right? So you are not allowed to steal, so the government shouldn't be able to steal. So people think that taxes are theft because you can make the argument, you know, how much of my labor belongs to the greater good or the, you know, the commons or whatever. And I would argue 0%. Like, I do give to charity. I do volunteer for things. And I'm not a goody two-shoes. It's just I live my principles. I don't want to outsource that to someone else. So with regard to social services, I think the government, to some extent, did destroy churches and sort of fraternal organizations and just community stuff, you know, like, I don't know, even a book group, you know, if one of your friends got sick or if someone had a baby, you know, we'd all go babysit one night and take food over. And I think it's just gotten to the sense where, you know, we just kind of all go, someone else is going to take care of it. And I think it's much more important to be like, I'm going to take care of it. You know, I have a woman who works for me now, and she just had a tragic accident, and her deck broke at her house in Canterbury, and she fell two stories, broke her back, and is now in a wheelchair and has been for like 3 years. And as a community, we were like, okay, we need to, she was a waitress, you know, she worked for the common man. She was, you know, she had some managerial responsibilities, and I mean, she couldn't work anymore. And we were like, okay, let's figure it out. Can we fundraise so that we can hire her so she could do some of the admin that, you know, needs to get done? And, you know, we did. And we run soup kitchens when people are in, you know, financial need. We really are trying to live our principles. You know, it's not just about, you know, harassing, in air quotes, the meter maids. It's also about, you know, really trying to live the, you know, what's that saying? Be the life.
Be the change you want to see in the world.
Yeah, exactly. And for most of us, that's really what we're trying to do. And so I would, you know, love to see people help each other more and not sort of be like, oh, you know, someone else is going to take care of grandma. Because we're also, I think the state destroys relationships between generations. And, you know, really, grandma should come live with you when she's getting old, you know, and she can look after the kids or maybe still cook a little. But that's the cycle of life. Like, we should all be good to each other and take care of each other. And I know that sounds utopian and not everyone is like that, but I just know philosophically, I don't think that the government has the right to dictate those things and to ultimately hurt people, because morally what they're doing is immoral.
Yeah, I wonder if some of those young men who are doing it think about that the utopia is going to, you know, their mom is going to move back in with them in their apartment. But yeah, no, I agree.
I mean, I guess one of the things that I have a conflict with in that thinking, although part of me is seduced by it, is the concept that, and granted, I do think government was a huge part of creating these systemic problems of sexism and racism and people not having true and genuine equal opportunity. And so what is the responsibility of the government right now, currently, to like the millions of black people we stole and brought to this country, or the women that have been subjugated that continue to be? And yeah, it would be, it's like, okay, government essentially created these problems. It's not like this mindset is going to fix them. But at the same time, I'm not necessarily convinced that humanity is also going to take true responsibility for themselves or each other when, like, in an individual basis, that's really hard to find. I mean, you're, like, a good person.
Yeah, finding a roommate who picks up their socks is hard to find.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. I definitely see the conflict of the state and the conflict of relying on government, yet there are these systemic and like psychological problems that have come to exist in people's minds that I'm not quite sure how the transition is going to work. I guess that's kind of my main question, and I'm not necessarily even saying you have the answer. It's just,
thank you.
It's just like when we're looking at, you know, the current environmental problems that we have and like the fact that, yeah, we're fighting our government for regulation on global warming. Like, that's crazy that we have to fight our government to stay alive. That's a problem. But at the same time, I'm trying to like wrap my head around like what the average person, like, I'm not a Democrat, I'm not a Republican, I will not identify with either of those groups. Yet what is my true power at this point? You know, it's like we're not just going to eliminate government because right now, like, those are the people in power. It's just like with corporations, those are the people in power. And yeah, we can vote with our dollars, but you know, if you look at the organic market, for instance, a huge percentage of it is owned by major corporations, you know? So it's like, there is this kind of hopelessness that I sometimes feel. So I guess what I'm asking is, how do you maintain hope when things kind of seem not futile or fruitless, but
insurmountable?
Yeah.
And it's not always easy. I keep hope by believing in, I actually am a really, really strong proponent, I think that's the word, of localism. So, you know, with something like the organic market, I'm like, I love living in New Hampshire because I know I source all my meat locally now. I know where my eggs come from. I know where my cheese comes from. Sometimes the cheese is the raw milk that I bought that went sour and then I got to do something with it. So sort of that idea of localism on steroids and just really taking, you know, responsibility. And of course, like, we all live in the real world too. You know, it's not, yes, I have to drive on the roads. Yes, I have to pay the tolls. Yes, government exists. Like, all of these things are there. But I think that what makes me hopeful and optimistic is at least like trying to change things. And maybe it comes from my background, from coming from South Africa and actually seeing like tangible changes. You know, when I was little, the idea of like Nelson Mandela being released from jail was like ludicrous, right? And it happened in my lifetime. And it's the only country that had an actual like real revolution that was fairly nonviolent as compared to like a lot of other places and as compared to how bad it could have been. I mean, there were nuclear weapons. The nationalists, you know, were doing worse things than the CIA, who were, you know, trying to poison Castro's beard and, you know, like, I mean, just crazy stuff, right? And so I have seen real change in my lifetime, and I believe we can see more of that. And I think the way we do it is we got to believe. We have to live our principles, and you have to remain optimistic. And then it's you know, as a writer, I have this thing on my computer at home, and it's like one word at a time, right? That's how you write an article. And I'm like, these are ideas. Ideas are bulletproof. I believe like we can change the world, and it's an issue of having that dialogue, starting to talk about these things, asking hard questions, you know, like, I'm not sure what the answer is to some of these things, but I do know the answer is not more government. I think the answer lies in something else.
Just inspiring people to examine their principles.
Exactly.
It's probably the very first place to start.
Yeah, people need to start to think.
And I think what you said to me that just kind of brought me out of my momentary intense depression that I was like falling into is like, I was like suddenly about to cry, is this idea of really focusing on your local community. And that if we can become true model citizens, regardless of our politics, in the neighborhoods and the towns that we live in, that has to make not only national but global change. So I really thank you for being on the show today.
Yes,
it was great talking to you.
Thank you for your time.
Your energy and your sweet face is converting me. So thank you so much.